Tech Talk on RNIB Connect Radio.
Hello and welcome into Tech Talk. I'm your host, Dave Williams. Tech Talk is the community's opportunity to come together and discuss the world of technology. It's your show and we really love to hear your voice. You can send a voice note or just a regular good old-fashioned email to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. This week, we'll be talking with blind author Amy Turnbull, who'll be sharing the tools and techniques that she used to write her debut novel. David Hock hears from Estee Lauder about their new accessible way to apply makeup, and we'll be catching up, of course, with your questions and queries. That's all to come this time on Tech Talk. Welcome in to our co-hosts, Tasneem Arshad, Callum Stoneman. How are you?
Really good. Yeah, looking forward to another week.
Yes, very good. Thank you.
And what's grabbing your attention at the moment in the world of technology?
I thought it was very interesting that Tyra Technology have got a kind of accessible power bank, which gives you the kind of battery levels with audios and, beeps and vibrations. So, yeah.
Yeah, have you got power banks, Callum?
I've got a couple. Don't really use them that much, to be honest. But yeah, they're always, the accessibility of them is a bit hit and miss. Most of the time, the battery level of the power bank itself is all done through nice flashy little LEDs, which are fantastic when you're completely blind.
Absolutely.
So, this accessible one from Tyra Technology looks pretty cool. It's one of them weird things. It's so simple. It's just giving the battery level by beeps. And, you know, yeah, 2023, we're excited about that. Yeah. How's it taken this long?
Well, yeah. It's a worry. I mean, of course, if you buy the Apple ones, you know, like the powered cases, you can see in the operating system exactly what the percentage of the case battery is. So you can add a widget to your home screen and you're able to find out how much battery the power supply has got. But obviously, that's only, you know, an Apple thing. I think generally you're absolutely right. So this new option might be a good one for lots of folk. How about you, Callum? What's on your plate?
I've just been looking into the news of, I'm really late to the party with this, but I've been playing around with the ChatGPT, which is like the artificially intelligence powered chatbot and super intelligent. And it's an amazing product. It's ridiculously impressive. And Microsoft have announced they're bringing that, I don't know about bringing ChatGPT itself, but the technology that it's powered by, they're looking at bringing that into Bing, which is their search engine, kind of Microsoft's version of Google, really, but it's not used very much, but they're bringing it into Bing. So you can just ask a normal question rather than doing a search term and getting millions of results that you've got to flick through. You'll be able to just ask this Bing chatbot a simple, well, quite a long, complex question, actually, and it will send you back a result. In a, you know, just one single result in a nice, easy to read format with citations and references. And it's incredible. I've signed up. There's a waiting list to try this out, which I've signed up for. So I'm excited to try out the new Bing, which is a sentence that I never thought I'd say. But there you go.
Yeah, well, it certainly does seem to be a new kind of battleground, doesn't it? You know, Google are getting involved in this. And of course, Apple have got AI work on the go as well. Of course, if you want to try ChatGPT and you don't want to wait for Bing, you can go along to chat.openai.com. That's chat.openai.com. And you will be needing to sign up with your email address.
If you're looking for love, then online dating might be a potential way that you could find someone and meet someone that you have a connection with. But of course, the big question for us is, how accessible are these online dating apps? And are blind and partially sighted people treated equally when they use them?
Now, have you ever tried your luck with online dating? Well, one person who has is Siobhan Mead, who is a video blogger. She goes by the social media name Blind Girl Vlogs. Siobhan also works for the Guide Dogs organization and joins us now to talk about online dating. Welcome to Tech Talk, Siobhan. It's good to have you here. How would you describe yourself before we get into this?
Okay, so I am a little bit of a tech dinosaur. I love tech and I love where it can take me to, but tech can sometimes be a bit of a challenge, a bit of a headache. But without it, I wouldn't be able to do half the things I do.
And we should say right out of the gate, in case anyone's getting any ideas, that you've dabbled with online dating, but you're not doing that just now. So if anybody starts looking for you, they're not going to find you.
They're not going to find me. My profile was deactivated as of last August.
Right.
But yeah, I have dabbled with online dating the first time ever.
And let's just kick off with a couple of safety tips before we get into the weeds of, you know, the apps and setting up a profile and making a connections. Just some really important, obvious things that I think we just need to say up front. Obviously, if you're doing online dating, it is at your own risk. If you're going to meet somebody, obviously tell somebody where you're going. Don't reveal passwords and credit cards. I know people should know this stuff already, but if you don't say it and then somebody does, you get into trouble, right?
Absolutely. And I think it's really important just to reiterate the safety aspect. It's always good to meet in a public place and just safeguard yourself, absolutely, by letting people know where you are.
Okay, so why did you try online dating?
For me, I think as a blind person, going into clubs and bars can be a bit of a challenge. You know, the whole blindness thing, you can't see if anyone's looking at you. You don't want to go up to someone who's potentially already in a relationship. And online dating just seemed the easiest option for me. It's very quick. You can look at different profiles. And I just thought, why not? I've never done it before, never had the opportunity, never needed to. And what with, I suppose, COVID still very much around, I wanted to kind of do something a little bit easier for myself.
And had you used any online dating apps or services previously?
No, never. So I wanted to kind of like look at the biggest one. And the biggest one that I went to, the first one, it was Tinder, because a lot of people said, oh, yeah, go on Tinder. It'll be great. It'll be fine. And I never needed to kind of look elsewhere.
Right. Okay. So just talk a bit about setting up your profile then. What was that like? What did you have to do? Were there any particular issues for you as a blind person?
In terms of setting up the Tinder profile, I got to the point mostly where I could say live and go. But as you probably be aware, there are so many different accessibility issues that I came across. So it wasn't plain sailing. I couldn't add or select photos because the buttons weren't labeled. And when I tried to, it just wouldn't allow me to upload. So that was the biggest kind of barrier, because you couldn't then kind of continue adding or finishing off your profile. And there were certain things that I couldn't edit or enter into to text boxes. So I had to get a trusty friend to kind of do that for me. And again, you don't necessarily always want someone, you know, to look at those sorts of things. It's quite a personal thing to kind of have to go through. But I have some good friends and they managed to do it for me.
Yeah, sometimes, unfortunately, we do have to lean on our friends. But you're absolutely right. It's you know, it's an empowerment thing. It's an independence thing. It's something that we want to do ourselves. So, OK, so you got a friend to help you get the right images uploaded, and you were able to presumably write your bio and that sort of stuff. So how about making connections then? So once your profile's live, what happens next?
So once you're live, you can go through the app and you can look at potential matches. Now, it doesn't really give you a lot of descriptions. Now, for me, as someone who is totally blind and rely on VoiceOver, the screen reading software, it didn't actually give me a lot of information on people's profile. It came up with the name, their age, and the location they lived, but that's about it. Then when I tried to tap into their profile, it was very hit and miss. That the VoiceOver would lose focus, the app would sometimes close you out, and then, you know, you have to start again. So a lot of it was, I think, very, very visual. Hence the reason I kind of had to get my friends sometimes to kind of say yes, no, swipe left if you don't, swipe right if you do. So I ended up finding myself just swiping right just because I had no other option. And it wasn't just like an ego thing. Hey, I've got 100 matches. It really is just the fact that I had no other way of knowing.
I mean, you mentioned there that one of the accessibility issues when you were setting up the profile was unlabeled buttons. And obviously, Tinder works by kind of auditioning images, essentially, so not on the face of it particularly blind friendly. Did you feed back to Tinder at all about some of the accessibility issues that you encountered?
I did actually send an email to say, look, this would be really useful as someone who is now using this platform. It would be really helpful if the buttons could be labeled or if accessibility could be looked at, because I'm essentially a customer, really. If I want to kind of like boost, or if I want to pay for a subscription, then, you know, I'm essentially a customer that's going to be bringing in the money. But until the buttons are labeled and I feel like I'm getting a service, I wasn't going to pay for anything. But I did actually feedback, because I think it's important to let them know where the areas are that they could improve. And I think it's such an easy thing for any designer looking at digital accessibility to do when you first implement an app. Look at that, because, you know, you're essentially excluding a large proportion of society if you're not making it universally designed in the planning stages.
Absolutely. It's always easier to build in accessibility from the start than try and retrofit it later. Did you make any connections?
I did. I actually did. I got chatting to several people, and it was going like really well until they found out I was blind, which kind of was a massive dent, because there was a couple that were potentials, and I did feel that, you know, we could meet. But I think it was the whole sense that their attitude was, well, if you're blind, I don't want to be a carer. Well, you know, I think that's just a little bit presumptuous to suggest that because I'm blind that I'm going to need a carer, not a potential partner. You know, I stayed on there for about 3 months and decided that, well, it just wasn't for me in the end, and came away from it.
Do you think that's possibly a reason for maybe disclosing earlier? Obviously, you chose not to disclose in your bio or whatever. You wanted to be evaluated on other things, and maybe people would be more reluctant to contact a blind person. But then I guess the flip side to that is that if you disclose earlier, then you're sort of saying take it or leave it, right?
Yeah, for me, I felt that it was important, you know, not to mention, because I didn't want my blindness to be defined in that way. However, I did have great big adoring guide dog Marty in my photos, because I thought, well, you know, that's a part of my life. And I didn't say that I was blind, but it kind of was insinuating, you know, through the pictures that I was. But I think it depends on each person if they want to kind of open that can and say that they are. Some people do, some people don't. I just feel that take me as I am, blindness or not.
And have you spoken with other blind and partially sighted people about their experiences with dating apps? Do those experiences tally with your own?
Yeah, absolutely. So I've spoken to quite a handful of people just about my own experience and how I found it, how they find it. Are they still looking? Do they disclose whether they're blind or not? Have they had any conversations and awkwardness around it? And the consensus is a lot of people do experience the same things I do, whether it's discrimination, whether it's someone saying, well, you know, blindness isn't for me, and without even knowing the person. So yeah, I think it's, you know, it's widely known that unfortunately these experiences aren't unique just to me.
So given all those challenges and limitations, some of which we've talked about in this conversation, do you think overall dating apps and online dating services, do you think they're a good option for blind people?
I do think they're a good option, because at the end of the day, you can sit at the comfort of your own home, you can speak to people, you can gauge what they're like through the conversations that you have. And I think it's a lot easier to build up those rapports and relationships rather than trying to go out into bars, clubs, nightclubs, and any other kind of social gathering that you go to, because it is a lot harder, admittedly. So yeah, I do think it's a good option. And I think if anyone is in the dating scene, it's the month of love, you know, give it a try. Let me know how you get on.
And what would you say to developers who are working on dating apps? How can they make their platforms and apps more accessible so that everyone is included?
I think the biggest thing for me is actually allow blind and visually impaired people or any community to test the apps, to have those conversations, to speak to people before building such an app and then having the issues down the line. Update the app regularly, keep it, you know, on board so people are able to kind of utilize it. So right at the beginning of designing any apps or any new features, definitely get it tested.
And final question, would you do it again?
I would. I absolutely would, because I did have a blast, even though there were some really awkward conversations. But I think, you know, that's just life. People need to learn. And, you know, we all are educated, aren't we, at the same time. So I definitely would do it again.
Siobhan Mead at Blind Girl Vlogs, thank you so much.
Thank you.
You're listening to RNIB Connect Radio. Estee Lauder Company has recently released the voice-enabled makeup assistant, which uses artificial intelligence to help blind and partially sighted people touch up their makeup. I'm now joined by Michael Smith, the Chief Information Officer, and Monica Rastogi, Executive Director of Corporate Culture, Relevancy and Inclusion and Diversity, both from Estee Lauder. Thank you both for joining me here today.
Thank you for having me.
So, first of all, very simply, what does the app do?
The voice makeup assistant application is a first of its kind artificial intelligence powered mobile app that helps visually impaired users more easily and confidently apply makeup. So it uses voice instruction technologies to assist the user in makeup application. You know, the users receive audio feedback, tips on whether their lipstick, eyeshadow, foundation is evenly applied. And, you know, using artificial intelligence, this app really identifies where makeup is applied on a user's face. It assesses whether it's uniform or is it within the boundaries, all of that for application and coverage of the makeup. And so it identifies any areas on the face that may require more accurate application. And, you know, it really describes where those touch-ups might be needed. And so, you know, our focus has really been on usability. We've tried to make the application as intuitive as possible so that there's really little to no learning curve. And, you know, this is the first version of the app. We're excited to start with this functionality. And, you know, we're gathering and incorporating the community's feedback. That's really important to us, and continue to deliver additional capabilities in near future releases.
And the fact that there must be an awful lot going into that AI to make sure that everything's taking over and working properly. What went into the making of this app? And initially, why was it made?
It was made because our goal is to be the most inclusive beauty company in the world. And we recognize that there are millions and millions of people that don't have full access to makeup and self-expression independently. And it was a real need that we felt like needed to be met. In terms of the, you know, the AI and what went into it, you know, we've spent a couple of years really building artificial intelligence and AR platform that really understands and digitizes the face and is responsive to many, many needs. We believe this is something that can drive many needs, meeting many needs across the community.
And Monica, I've heard you say elsewhere that the beauty industry is an early stage of bringing in the inclusivity for blind and partially sighted people and other disabilities as well to make it more accessible for everyone across the board. Just how important do you think that apps like the VMA are to improving that and also reflecting, as Michael said, the diversity of your customer base?
Yeah, well, you know, as Michael said, you know, we strive on the idea that we want to be the most inclusive beauty company in the world. And if we think about that, and we think about the fact that disabled and neurodiverse communities are really the biggest minority population in the world, how can we not include them as consumers sort of in the journey? But I think as an industry, we are in nascent stages when it comes to inclusion. I think disability inclusion is starting to bubble up as a bigger topic. But I think what needs to happen and what's amazing about this app is that this is an app that has proprietary Estee Lauder Company's technology. However, it is an app that can be used with products from any beauty brand, any makeup brand, really thinking about how can we advance this idea of disability inclusion across the industry. And I think the key to it is it's not something that sits with tech or it's not something that sits with ID&E, but really how do we think about it holistically across our business? What are we doing across education? What are we doing when we think about our stores, you know, when we think about online, and really kind of tasking everybody in the organization to really think about all those touch points, because that's the only way that you're going to really be able to drive progress and, you know, sort of that inclusive element. And I think one of the things we also think about is around this idea of inclusive design or inclusive experiences. If you can improve an experience for people, for instance, if I use an example, very simple, of if you increase font size on a website or in store, you're actually improving the experience for someone like myself who wears glasses so that I have better visibility. But then you're also including people who maybe have never been a part of the conversation, who haven't felt included. So this idea of how can you improve an experience for all and bring in people who feel like they've never been included or a part of the conversation.
Yeah, and even tiny things like increasing the font size or even giving people the option to increase the font size, it doesn't take an awful lot of effort on the back end to make it, but it does make a massive difference. And as you said, makes people feel included. Is it a case of be the change that you want to see in the world?
Yeah, you know, I think you have to start somewhere. And I think while we are at nascent stages, I think this app is incredible as first of its kind, but it is one step. And I think sometimes there is this discomfort or what if I don't get it all right? But you have to go out there, you have to try. And I think, you know, like I said, with this app, you know, we're trying to not only make progress for ourselves in this world of disability inclusion, but really thinking about the industry. So I think absolutely, if you can empower people, you know, makeup should be fun. Makeup should make people, you know, feel confident, feel good. And so if we can do that through something like this incredible app, you know, it's kind of going to the core of why people want to engage with the beauty industry in general.
Yeah. And to Monica's point, this is just the first step, not just for this app, but really our entire inclusive tech agenda. We have a team focused on inclusive tech and how do we leverage technology to continue to make beauty more and more accessible.
Fantastic stuff. Well, finally, if any of our listeners would like to download the voice-enabled makeup assistant, where can they do so?
The app is actually available on the Apple App Store in the UK currently. It's compatible with iPhones 8 and above, and you have to have iOS 14.1. But while it's, you know, on the App Store today in the UK, it is targeted to launch on Google Play within the next year and across other markets in the near future. So definitely watch this space. And we encourage, you know, all of your listeners to really download the app, to use it, but to also feedback. You know, as with all apps, you know, we can only get better as we reiterate and we get feedback from the community. On the app, you can actually feedback on demand using a voice command, and you can open settings and then you can select feedback from the menu, and then you'll be able to share comments with the team. And you can also, of course, leave reviews on the App Store.
Well, Michael Smith and Monica Rastogi from Estee Lauder Company, thank you so much for joining me here on R&IB Connect Radio.
Thank you, David.
Thank you so much, David.
Thanks very much to David Hogg. Tasneem Arshad, would you trust an app to help you with your makeup?
I'm not sure. I mean, I look like a panda the best of times when I'm trying to, you know, put on makeup. So I'm really curious to know how it would work in person. And I think I'll be testing it out and letting you know how I get on with it.
Brilliant. Well, if you could press record and send us in a little demo, that'd be amazing.
Absolutely.
Thank you. Thanks so much to those of you who have been in touch. Our programme about AI narration seems to have generated quite a bit of interest, not least of which from William Richards, who sent us this.
Hi team. I thought that, given your recent episode, I'd use a text-to-speech voice instead of sending you an email. The notion of audiobooks being read with text-to-speech voices intrigues me. Even though it does open up the market to narrating hard-to-find texts, there is something to be said for having a human narrator who can do the voices and use the proper emotion. As an example, James Masters narrates the Dresden Files on Audible, and I don't think they'd be so good if he didn't, or, at least, I probably wouldn't have stuck with the series. On the flip side of that, I have definitely seen books that I would be interested in were it not for the fact that the narrator sends me to sleep or makes me want to jump off a bridge, so I suppose that it is a case of swings and roundabouts. I know the Amazon Echo can read out your Kindle book to you, although, while that might be okay for audio describing a film, I'm not sure that I'd want to spend 10 or more hours with a robot voice. Can we use the term artificially generated as opposed to artificial intelligence to describe these? My point about audio described films being done by artificial intelligence was more that, if the AI can watch the film, write the script, and record the AD, then that would truly be AI, whereas I'm not sure that this is. You should definitely be frightened by this because, first, DALL-E came for the artists, then ChatGPT came for the writers and coders, now the machines are coming for you. And now, just because I can, I give you the sound of Pac-Man dying. Anyway, bye for now. Will.
We would love to hear your actual voice, William, but great to hear Pac-Man there. Also, Graham has been in touch on the same subject, and Graham says, like many blind people, I'm an avid reader of talking books, but I object to the use of synthetic speech. It might be okay for information, such as the RNIB New Books CD. Callum, do you think that's broadly where people are falling on this, that when it comes to a performance, you know, where there's drama involved, we want humans for that, and where it's information, we'll quite happily accept a TTS?
I think so, yeah. That's where I am at the minute. But again, we really don't know where this is going yet. We're still in the early days, and it's scarily good at the minute. So it's kind of scary that this is where we are at the minute and we're saying it's early days. So at the minute, I think, yeah, for something that's informational or for something that's non-fiction, AI is fine. But a fictional book, I mean, I can't think of examples, but yeah, a fictional thing where there really needs to be performance, there needs to be expression, there needs to be emotion. It's not there yet.
Yeah, if you're, you know, sort of reenacting Shakespeare or Dickens or whatever it might be, then I don't think that can be done with AI. So, yeah, you definitely need humans for that. Absolutely.
From Ricky, who is interested in accessible radios. And Ricky says they're on the lookout for a good old-fashioned radio that has some accessibility, not necessarily a connected internet radio. Ricky tells us about the Sanjin D17 talking radio and wonders if anyone has heard of any others. Tasneem, Callum Stoneman.
I've not heard of this one, but yes, it sounds very interesting. And I know that, again, Tyra Technology are working on a talking product for radio. That's in their kind of pipeline. But yeah, I don't know of any others.
I was going to say the same thing. I know Tyra Technology, they're working on this. They're trying to, they're very much at the prototype stage at the minute. They're trying to get prototypes developed, was the last I heard a few months ago. But there isn't really any other options. I've never heard of this one either. And I think Ricky mentions there, he's not sure if it's available in the UK, which I think is probably a key thing here with these FM or DAB radios, that they might not work in other countries. There is the closest one I know of is the RNIB radio, which is more of a large screen radio, but with voice prompts. But unfortunately, those voice prompts don't include the station names.
Well, let us know your thoughts about accessible radios, digital or otherwise. I picked up just one of those little pocket, you know, FM/AM radios last summer. I think I probably paid about £20. I was going travelling and I just wanted to have a good old-fashioned analogue radio, you know, with batteries that you can change yourself. Remember them? Anyway, let us know what you've got. And finally, then, we heard from John Gallagher.
Hi, all. What a great show. This is John Gallagher from Woodlesford in Leeds, and I would just like to say about my iPhone 14 Pro camera. I've left it at the settings, the original ones, and is there a way to make it sort of better, with regards for mobility. One of my great loves in life is sat-nav. I do still find the sat-nav is absolutely essential, and I've purchased a couple of holders for the phone so the camera can see in front of me. I'm wondering which is the sort of best way to go. I did try the door-to-door detection, and obviously, really, you do need AirPods or something to listen to your phone because the traffic noise is so difficult. It's fascinating, really, the amount of choice we have now. I'll never forget back in the late 90s when I directed the chap at Windermere Manor to find the Liverpool football ground with my sat-nav because he got lost. And people were just astounded. I was using the HumanWares Braille Note software then, and I used to use that lots when I worked all over Yorkshire and go down to Retford tuning the pianos. Are there any better ways? I know you can get into the magnifier with, is it a four finger double or triple tap? And then you go into settings, and then you go into settings, and you can change some of the settings. But sometimes when I use my camera to scan things like tins and jars, it says low light. And I think, oh, hang on, this is meant to be an iPhone 14 Pro with a really good camera. So I'm wondering whether there's a problem with my camera settings.
Callum Stobman, have you tweaked your camera settings to support navigation?
Cheers, John. A really nice message there. So this is a bit of an interesting one. So I don't think there are any settings that you can really change to make navigation itself better. I think we're at a stage at the minute where this is really early days in using something like LiDAR for navigation. I get the feeling that it's a bit of a proof of concept at the minute. They're kind of saying this is where this technology could go. This is where this is part of what this technology could do. So the way I normally do it is use something like Lazarillo or Blind Square or Good Maps, and they don't use the camera, they just use GPS and your location and the address that you've selected to give you directions. But then try just using LiDAR, something like door detection, just as a last resort. You know, let's say Good Maps, as an example, gets you somewhere and you know that you're in the car park, but you're just not entirely sure where the building is and there's no one around to help for whatever reason, then you could try the door detection there as well, and it might just get you through. But it's not quite at a completely reliable, you know, use it all the time stage yet, but I think soon it will be.
But most GPS apps are probably not using the camera at this stage.
No, they're not. No, I mean, you've got some exceptions, like, well, this isn't GPS, but you've got the door detection, you've got seeing AI's indoor navigation that we spoke about last week, your more traditional sat nav apps, you know, your Blind Square, Good Maps, even Apple Maps and Google Maps. They're not using the camera, then they're not touching the camera at this point.
John also asked about object recognition. He said that when he's trying to scan tins, that there's, you know, issues with lighting. Any tips there, Callum?
I would say it depends what you're using, because if you're using the built-in camera app, yes, it can do it. It's got the text recognition built in and it can describe objects, but I would go with a dedicated app for something like that. I would have a look at Scene AI or Envision AI if you're able to grab either one of those apps, or just grab both. I've got a couple of different apps, and sometimes, you know, when Scene AI doesn't give me the result I want, I could try Envision and that might get me through. So both those apps are free. So if you can, just, you know, go into your app store, give them a go. I know Scene AI, I'm not sure if Envision does this, but I know Scene AI will automatically, for example, turn on your torch. So if it knows that you're in low light, it will do that for you.
Speaking to photographers, they usually tell me that you need your light source to be behind camera position. So if you know that the light is coming in through the window or is above you, try to orient the device such that the light is falling on the thing that you are taking the photograph of or that you're trying to scan. But it is tricky and it does come with experience. And we've got some undercupboard lighting now in the kitchen, which I find has really improved things when trying to recognise objects. But anyone got any tips for John in terms of how to get the best out of your phone's camera, then do let us know. Thanks very much, Callum Stoneman, Tasneem Arshad. And if you'd like to get in touch, it's techtalk@rnib.org.uk. Now, it's often said that for many of us, we have a book inside us waiting to get out, and maybe in some cases that book should just stay right where it is. But somebody who has put virtual pen to paper is blind author Amy Turnbull. And Amy joins us now to talk about her novel and the process and some of the technology that was used in its creation. Welcome to Tech Talk, Amy. Fantastic to have you with us. How are you?
Yeah, I'm good. Thanks for having me.
Good, good. Have you always wanted to be an author?
No, not really. I read a lot and I don't really think I wanted to be an author until I was midway writing the book, really. I didn't start writing with the intention of publishing. I wrote just because I enjoyed writing, and it was more friends' feedback that's made me kind of carry on and finish it.
Right, because I've heard you sort of thinking out loud on social media for what feels like a number of
forever.
Years. Yeah, about, oh, I'm going to write this book. And eventually you did it. And we'll talk about that process in a bit. So it was just you had a story that you wanted to tell. That was the thing that drove it, I guess.
Yeah, no, what actually drove it was I started writing. I used to write when I was at school. I used to write little stories, but anyway, I hadn't done it for years, so probably since I've left university. And I started writing in 2015 for no real reason, and I took the first opening scene for some unbeknown reason to a uni gathering and read it to my friends, and the reception was like, they were like, it's really good, you need to carry on, we want to know what happens. And it was very much a very small group of people that made me go, actually, I probably could do this.
So it was the friends that gave you the confidence to carry on.
Yeah, definitely. And once I decided that, then I was like, actually, I am gonna finish it, and I am gonna publish it.
Right. And do you read a lot as well? A lot of writers tend to read.
Yeah, I love reading. I've always loved reading, and predominantly I prefer reading hard copies of Braille, which I think I'm in the minority of, and I listen to audio, but my preference is always Braille.
Because?
I think I prefer it because I visualise things better when it's just me reading it rather than a voice. And I prefer reading hard copies of Braille rather than reading on a Braille display, just because I find it quicker. That's not to say that I don't read books, Kindle books on a Braille display, because I do, but my preference, if I could have like the entirety of all of the books in my house were Braille, that would be great, but it takes up a bit too much space.
Yeah, and I often trot out this line about, you know, you find your own voice rather than the filter of somebody else's voice. Do you find that when you're reading it, you feel a stronger connection with the content?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I didn't used to listen to audiobooks, really. I really didn't enjoy audiobooks until, I don't know, I probably was in my 30s. I was quite late to joining Audible. I generally just preferred reading. I have kind of changed my mindset on that. I think audiobooks definitely have a place. But yeah, reading, a lot of my life was spent in Braille books.
So tell us a bit about how you write then. What's your process then? What tools do you use?
So I started writing, the whole of the books was written on my iPhone using a Bluetooth keyboard. And the reason why I started doing it that way was I used to travel a fair bit on trains, and I just wanted to write as I was traveling and not have to have a laptop with me. And also I get slightly concerned about what people can see on screen. So I just used to turn my screen curtain off and write. And it's, you know, it's easy to have a phone. So the whole of the book was written on my phone.
And did you use any particular apps for that? Did you have any software that you leaned into?
I used Voice. It's called Writer. Is it Voice Stream Writer?
Okay. It's a specialist app designed for blind and partially sighted people. So it's pretty accessible.
Voice Stream, isn't it?
Yeah, Voice Stream Writer. So they've got Voice Stream Reader, I think is probably the better known app. And then they've also got this Writer app. And had you tried a few at that point, or was it just the first one?
So I'd originally started writing it in Notes. Then I moved to Writer for no real reason, just that someone had recommended it and quite liked it, found it easy to edit it. I didn't have OneDrive at that moment in time, so I just used the Writer app. And then once I'd finished writing it all, I then used my laptop to proofread. And at that point, because there were loads of typos in it, just because I was just using a Bluetooth keyboard and doing it quickly and not really concentrating. So then I went to my laptop and used Word and used a Braille display at that point to do the proofreading, just a kind of initial high level proofread.
Right. So the whole thing with the phone and the Bluetooth keyboard, that was just to get the story down, get the idea out. And that was your sort of first draft. And, you know, we sometimes hear about sighted authors writing in longhand in exercise books and that kind of thing. I guess that was your equivalent then.
Yeah. And it was the whole story. So like I have like all different chapters are all in files and stuff on my iPhone. So once I've got to where I needed to get to with a chapter, I would move it over. I think I lost a couple of chapters, which is why I then invested in OneDrive and saved everything to the cloud, because I did manage to wipe a few things that I shouldn't have done. So then I moved to doing kind of a very light proofread using Braille display. But the way that I properly proofread and got kind of an idea of speed and length of my book was to emboss it all into Braille.
Wow. So you've got an embosser at home then?
I had an embosser in the office at work and had to kind of ask someone, can I print off my book? And they said, yes. I have an embosser now at home. So
Braille embossers are notoriously bulky and loud. And I imagine if you're embossing out an entire novel, that's got to have taken a while.
Yeah, I did it in chapters and generally kind of after most people had gone home. But yeah, I would do it kind of as I was writing, and I found the proofreading process again a lot easier to have the actual physical Braille copy and then the laptop, and I would change things and do it that way.
Okay, so there was those sort of three distinct stages then, really, the Bluetooth keyboard and the Voice Stream Writer on the phone, keeping each chapter in a separate file, and then your sort of bit on the laptop with the Braille display, but then the real proof reading, I guess, the real heavy living. And how long did this all take then? Is it a long book? I've not read it, I have to confess, Amy, and I'm hoping by the end of this chat you'll have persuaded me that I need to.
So the book is 115,000 words. It took me 2 years to write the book, and then I've never been very good at editing or looking over my own work. Like I was the person in exams who would write what they needed to write and then leave, because I just have never been very good at going back over things that I've written myself. I can look at other people's stuff, but just my own stuff I struggle with. So I took a bit of time out completely away from it, and then life took over and had like personal stuff to deal with. So writing a romance wasn't kind of conducive with personal situation. But then when I went back to it, it wasn't a lot of the content didn't need changing. It was just really tedious typos. And from the main first draft to the actual final book, there are a couple of things that have been taken out, but generally speaking, most of it stayed.
So give us a bit of a synopsis then, Amy. You mentioned there that it's a romance. Can you tell us about the main sort of protagonists and sort of set it up for us?
So it is a romance. There are some explicit scenes in it, but I would say that it has a story, and it's very much about two characters falling for each other. It's first person, so it's told by Rosie Fielding, who is a recruitment officer. She's 35, and she has recently become single from a very long-term relationship, and she meets and falls very quickly in love with an American man called Ethan Harbour, who she works with, and he is the boss at the company that she works for. He arrives at a, she meets him at a summer party, and he has come in to kind of take over.
Okay. Okay. And did you have to do any research? Did this come all out of your own head, or did you go anywhere? Did you have to make notes or record interviews with anybody or anything like that?
I did research. So on cars, I did a bit of research with friends because I don't know very much about cars. So I kind of needed to look into that. And I have a couple of chapters in New York, which I've never been to, sadly, and definitely want to go to. So I did quite a research on New York and spoke to people who had been to New York just to try and get a feel for a city that I have never experienced, but I needed to write about.
And in terms of the sort of the tools for those interviews, would you record the interview or were you making notes? How did that work?
Generally, I'd write notes or I would ask a question on Facebook and see what people came back with. Social media did help, actually. There were times I'd even go onto Facebook or Twitter and ask a question. But yeah, I didn't generally make notes. I used to ask online. Oh, another part of the book, actually, that's probably worth saying is that there were two people that read my book as I was writing it. One of them was my friend Vicky, who I read it to her chapter by chapter over the phone. So she heard the whole thing. I read it to her. And also to Ruth as well over the phone. They, for some reason, they wanted me to read it to them. But when I'd finished it, I sent the book to Ruth for her to proofread and to beautify, because my formatting is terrible. And, you know, half of it was in one font and then another font because I've written it in different places. The Bluetooth keyboard speech marks was somehow different, very slightly different to my laptop's speech marks in the way that it looked. So I couldn't tell, but they looked slightly different. So she had a very, very tedious job of making sure that they were consistent. So yeah, my friend proofread it for me. And I also needed to get a cover as well, a book cover. And I asked someone that I used to work with, who used to do the website design at the place that I used to work, and he designed it. I had a rough idea of what I wanted, and he brought that to life.
I mean, were you just completely happy to hand off things like formatting and the cover to somebody else to kind of look at the design? You were more about the words for you, or did you have long meetings about how it was going to look aesthetically?
So the font and things like that, I wasn't that bothered about. The cover, I had a rough idea of what I wanted the cover to look like. And I explained it to Steve and said, this is kind of, but I think I was very vague at the beginning of like what I wanted it to look like. And then I had a couple of people that had read the book. So when he designed the cover, he sent me the first draft and I sent it to them and said, what do you think? And they were like, oh, I don't like it. And I was like, okay, but what don't you like about it? Because you've got to tell me so I can decide whether I like it. It just was, I think the colouring was off and the font was too small. And so then I had to go back to him and say, actually, had some feedback, can you make it? And he was really, really good. And then when he sent me the second draft over, he was very descriptive about the colours and the font used. And I felt that it kind of made more sense with the book that it was having a cover for. And everyone was like, yeah, that's much better. Like, but the actual book itself, how it looked, I wasn't so worried about.
Okay.
I just trusted people.
Right. So then we come to getting it to other people. Clearly you wanted to make it available, not just that sort of offer around a Word document. You actually wanted to get it sort of available somewhere where people can go and discover it.
Yep. So I'd looked into publishing. Once I decided that I wanted to actually make it into a book properly, because it took so long and I had some time out, and once I'd got to the end, I just got to the stage where I just wanted it out there. So I'd done a bit of research about publishers, but I just wasn't in the right mind that I wanted to look for an agent or I wanted to write to publishers. I just wanted it out there. So I chose to self-publish through Amazon because it's very, very simple. And also Amazon do sell like the majority of books.
So you self-published on Amazon, and did you do that yourself? Is that something you needed help with?
I did get a friend to upload it all. Whether I could have done it myself, I don't know. I think I would have always wanted that visual kind of assistance just to make sure that it looked okay. But yeah, my friend Layla put it all online for me. And then I remember she was like, okay, it's live now, because I have a Kindle version and a paperback version. So like then I downloaded the Kindle version just to, you know, check it through before I told anyone, that because I had like visions of chapters being missing and I'd tell everyone it was published and then there'd be something wrong. So I made sure that I read it first before I said it was available.
Right. So when you self-publish on Amazon, it appears on Kindle pretty quickly then. Yep. And you can order the paperback, or is it in hardback at all? Or
no, I decided not to put it in hardback. I just think the type of book that it is, it's more of a kind of, you know, pick it up in the airport type book. It's not, I think probably paperback feels the right format, I think. I also decided eventually that I would do an audio version as well.
Ah, yes. Yeah. Now explain about that. So how did you approach the audio version?
I used ACX, which is Amazon's audio kind of self-publishing offering, and you can put a little audition up there, a little audition script, and people can come and audition. And I was very impatient, so I put a little bit up, and I got my narrator, Rebecca McKernan, auditioned. I did at one point consider whether I could read it myself, and I decided that I couldn't do an American male's voice well enough. It's so difficult. So I decided the right thing to do was to get someone else to read it. And so I published in July. I decided that I was going to get the audio, because originally I thought it would cost quite a lot, but it didn't cost as much as I thought. So I then had Rebecca started working on it in September, and it was available on Audible in December.
So the book now, tell us the title so everyone can go and have a...
Yay. The book is called More, with an exclamation at the end. And yeah, I had my 100th sale on Sunday, which I was very excited about. So,
well, that is exciting. And have you done any publicity other than, you know, sort of social media?
No, just social media. So I have a Twitter account, which is an author Twitter account, which is Turnbull Amy.
Amy with an I, we should say.
It is Amy with an I, yeah.
Yeah.
And I have been... using that to kind of promote it.
So what have you learned, you know, thinking about the sort of the tools and the technology that you use to bring your novel to Amazon? What do you think you've sort of learned from this process? If you were writing another one, what would you do differently?
I think I would still write it on my phone, but I obviously now know that the speech marks look slightly different, so I would change that as I go along rather than doing it right at the end, because it was very tedious. I think I would still use exactly the same tools that I did last time, and yeah, I think I would pretty much do it all the same. I definitely prefer writing more than I do like editing it, so yeah.
I guess if you're rich and famous, you can have an editor who'll take all that pain away. So are you planning any more?
I am writing another one at the moment. I've begun to write it, so yeah, but completely separate story. But yeah, I just enjoy writing. Is a bit of space to just think something else that is not real, and I find it quite kind of cathartic. So,
well, congratulations, Amy Turnbull. More is available from Amazon, and if you want audio, you can find that on Audible. Brilliant stuff. Well, we look forward to future books, Amy, from you, and hearing more about your process. And have you got a website, or is there a place where people can kind of follow along for any news or updates?
No, just Twitter, which I always thought that Twitter was quite a romantic kind of sending tweets out into the void. So yeah, Twitter is my place.
And remind us again, you on Twitter, you are...
So I'm Turnbull Amy, Turnbullami.
Excellent. Well, Amy Turnbull, once again, thanks for joining us here on Tech Talk.
Thanks so much, Dave.
Thank you. And that brings us to the end of another Tech Talk. Thank you so much for your company. Lovely to have you there as always. And if you would like to contact us here at the programme, then do record a voice note or just a good old-fashioned email, and you can send that in to techtalk@rnib.org.uk. techtalk@rnib.org.uk. That's it. Thanks very much. Callum Stoneman, bye for now.
Cheers. Bye for now.
Tasneem Arshad.
See you soon.
And from me, Dave Williams, and the rest of the Tech Talk team, until next time, bye-bye.